conjunction with Parshiyot HaShavua that we are reading in Sefer Shmot currently, and adjoining that, since in 2 weeks we are celebrating Tu Bishvat, which does talk about the idea of nature, I decided to speak about this topic of nature, miracle, the Makot in Egypt. It's very interesting that the term Makot, referring to the plagues, only appears one time in all of Tanakh. And it happens to appear in the mouths of the Plishtim in Shmuel Aleph when they are very concerned that they are going to be destroyed by the God who sent forth the Makah in Egypt against the against Paro and his fellow Egyptian people. In fact, this term is only referred to otherwise in the Haggadah and in rabbinic writings. We see in Mishnah, in the Masechet Avot, in source number 1, that we learn that there were 10 miracles that were done to our Avot in Egypt, as well as 10 miracles done by the sea. But notice how it refers to these miracles afterwards in the latter part of the source where I underlined Eser Makot Hevi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Al HaMitzriim B'Mitzrayim. The Tanakh, however, refers to these events not as Makot, but as Otot and Moftim, signs, wonders, marvels. Only with the last plague, Makat Bechorot, is it referred to once as a Nega in Shmot Yud Aleph, and in Tehillim Kuf Lamed Vav LeMakeh Mitzrayim Bivchorehem. Otherwise, the Makot are referred to as Otot and Mofetim, signs, wonders, marvels. For example, we just read in this week's parasha, V'ani akshet lev paro, V'hirbeti et ototai v'et moftai v'eret mitzrayim. Or in Shmot Perek Yud, Uleman tesaper be'ozne vincha uven vincha v'et ototai asher samti bam. Interestingly, with regard to this anomalous reference to what we generally call the plagues in Egypt, why the number 10? If we count the sign of the rod turning into the tanin, we now have 11 signs and marvels. If we count in addition the drowning at Yam Suf, then that's 12 signs, wonders, and marvels. Why the number 10? It seems that we are only counting those signs that were blows against Egypt, and only those performed in Mitzrayim itself. In fact, the notion of 10 makot, eser makot, appears first in this Mishnah in Masechet Avot that I quoted to you in source number 1, as well as in other Midrashic literature. The question becomes, why the insistence on the number 10? To the point that, as we will discuss, as we know from the Haggadah, Rabbi Yehuda establishes a mnemonic device, Ditzach Adash Be'achav. There are those who want to say that perhaps this is meant to contrast with other texts within Tanakh that enumerate the Makot, texts in Tehillim Ayin Chet, as well as Tehillim Kufhei. Tehillim Ayin Chet, however, only mentions 7 plagues. Tehillim Kufhei only mentions 8 plagues, which is certainly less than the 10 that Mishnah Masechet Avot enumerates. This might be for this purpose of emphasizing that indeed there were 10, but why the Tehillim, these Mizmorim, only enumerate 7 or 8 might be because of a particular thematic or didactic motive with regard to the context of those particular Mizmorim. But I would like to analyze from a slightly different perspective. that the 10 makot, enumerating them as 10, provides us with a means of discerning an inner arrangement, a literary symmetry, a logical structure and grouping of the makot, and in turn, this will help us to discern their purpose, their motivations. Because when we look at the story of the makot in Sefer Shmot, what should strike us as unusual is that we do not see the makot described explicitly as punishments, whereby there is a cause-effect, midah keneged midah, aspect to these particular makot, i.e., because the Egyptians persecuted us in this particular way, that is why they are being plagued with this particular makah. We do not have these cause-effect explicit midah keneged midah statements delineated within the course of the plague narratives. In fact, what we seem to get a sense is that they have more of a didactic, pedagogic, educational motive rather than being presented in that negative sense as punishments. And yet the word makah, as the Mishnah and the Masechet Avot qualifies and describes these particular signs, wonders, marvels, otot umoftim, the word makah certainly implies a negative connotation as well. And this is what we need to grapple with. How do we understand the purpose, the motivation of the makot? And perhaps we can discern that through, in fact, the arrangement of the makot is a series of 10. But when we finally delineate and understand the literary arrangement, the structure and the symmetry of the makot as this grouping of 10, and how we can divide up the 10 perhaps into smaller groupings, that will enable us to then tackle the larger question regarding the plagues themselves, and that is the interesting interrelationship between nature and miracle. So I would like you to just pay attention, just to scan the sources for the moment. Then in source number 2 from the Midrash Tanchuma, it analyzes the 10 makot as 2 groupings of 5. Whereas in sources 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, we are going to see that these commentaries are heavily influenced by Rabbi Yehuda's groupings of the 10 makot as 3 by 3. 3 sets of 3. Makat Bechorot is often separated out. But if you will turn the page for the moment, you will see that in source number 8, a modern scholar, Kasuto, of the 20th century, he organized the makot into 5 groups of 2s. So already we see that the arrangement of the makot is not unidimensional. There are many different ways to organize them and to group them, understanding that they are, in their totality, 10 makot. What is the purpose of this kind of theoretical exercise to go out of their way to find subgroupings within the totality of the 10? Well, let's analyze them and see what we can glean from these different interpretations. In fact, what we will begin to realize is that the patterns and the symmetry are going to suggest to us that the makot and the way they occur in the order and the sequence that they are implemented demonstrate a divine plan. That these are not merely natural coincidences, these are not merely quirks of nature, but that in fact there is a premeditated, well-planned out divine scheme. And they are going to involve teaching us a lot about the relationship between Hashem and the enemy, Paro, between Hashem and his human agents who are implementing the Makot, Moshe and Aharon, and between Hashem and the different forces of nature. Here we're going to have some medieval science between the so-called heavy elements and the lighter elements of nature. Let's take this step by step and show you the intricate analyses within the various parshanim. So the Midrash, going back to source number 2, tells us that in the first 5 makot regarding the hardening of Paro's heart, the text says, Vayechazak lev Paro, that Paro hardened his heart of his own will and volition. In the second line of source 2, Kevan sheba'u chamesh makot velo shalach, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu mikan va'elach, im ratza lishloach, eini mekabel. Shekach ketiv b'chamesh makot ta'acharonot, v'yechazek Hashem et lev Paro. Since in the first 5 makot, Paro decided to be quite obdurate, quite inflexible and stubborn, and refused, despite the increasing severity of the Makot, to release the Jews to freedom, Hashem decides in the last 5 Makot that he is going to enable Paro, whether actively or passively, that's certainly another shiur about the hardening of Paro's heart, but Hashem is going to intervene in some manner to enable Paro to continue along his path that he himself has charted, the direction that he himself seems to be very intent on going and pursuing. And Hashem is going to make sure that Paro's heart remains hardened so that he can enact the last 5 makot. We need to perhaps recall 2 very important texts within Sefer Shmot. In the beginning, when Moshe Rabbeinu, in last week's Parashat Shemot, accosts Paro, Paro says to Moshe, Mi Hashem, it's in Perek Hei, Pasuk Bet, Mi Hashem asher eshma bekolo leshalach et Yisrael. Lo yadati et Hashem, v'gam et Yisrael lo ashaleach. Paro says, who is this God who is telling me to send out Bnei Yisrael? I do not know this God, and I am not freeing this people. Lo yadati et Hashem kind of reminds us of the early part of Sefer Shmot, which the Paro says, right, lo yada et Yosef. Well, how could he have not heard of Yosef? The verb yada, as Onkelos teaches us, doesn't mean simply to know, but in political context it means I do not accept the authority of this particular individual, or lo yadati et Hashem. I do not accept the authority, the sovereignty of this particular God. Egyptian kings considered themselves to be as deities. So already in this setup of 2 groups of 5, we are beginning to realize that the thematic underpinning of the Makot is that there is a clash, a confrontation, an open conflict that is being enacted between the Egyptian king, who considers himself to be a deity, and Hashem, who is going to render this king, this deified king, impotent and completely powerless before his people. Let's also recall yet another text that we read this past Shabbat, right before Makat Barad. In that particular context, Hashem says through Moshe Rabbeinu, he says to Paro, Ki ata shalachti et yadi, it's Perek Tet, Pasuk Tet Vav, ואח אותך ואת עמך בדבר ותיכחד מן הארץ. He says to Paro, you know, Paro, if I wanted as a god, I could have just sent out in one fell swoop a pestilence, and I could have killed you and your entire nation all at once. I don't need to go through 1, 2, 3, up to 10 plagues. I don't need to go through a whole series of plagues. I am God and all-powerful. I could have destroyed you all at once. But the pasuk continues, Ve'ulam, why am I going through this whole series of events? Ba'vul zot he'emadaticha, because of this reason, you are still standing before me. Ba'avur, listen carefully, ha'otecha et kochi, so that I may demonstrate my strength, uleman saper shemi bechol ha'aretz, so that I can have you tell everyone throughout the land about my shame. And shame does not merely here mean a name. It means to spread my reputation. Spread my name, right? Even we say it in English. To spread my reputation far and wide. You, Paro, are going to become my divine emissary. You are the one who are going to spread the word about the great powers of my divine capabilities, of who I am as Hashem, the only God. So already we're seeing that not only from this two grouping, these two groupings of five and five, not only are we dealing with the Makot as punishments, but it seems that also the Makot are meant to be pedagogic, to be educational, to send an important message. Let's show that even further in source number 3. The Rashbam, who most probably is influenced by the three groupings that I quoted to you from the Haggadah in source number 4, Tetzach, Adash, and Ahav, notices something very interesting within each set of three makot. Shnei pe'amim, source number 3, haya Moshe matre et paro, bishnei makot, uvashlishi lo haya matre. וכן כל הסדר וכל שלוש מכות אינו מטרה. And he enumerates all 10. Within each set of 3, the first 2 makot, Paro is warned. In the last makah of each set, there is no forewarning. We can elaborate on that, as does the Ramban and other Parshanim, that interestingly, in the first warning for each of the 3 sets, Moshe Rabbeinu is told to accost and confront Paro at the Nile River. Hityatzev lifnei Paro, v'nitzavta likrato. In the second of each of the 3 sets, Moshe is told, bo el Paro, to go to Paro, particularly to the palace, i.e. to the 2 places where Paro feels in a very glorified manner. They used to worship the Nile River itself as a deity. Paro is showing his control over the land through the powers of the Nile, or Moshe accosts him in his very place of governance in his palace. These are the 2 places where he is warned. But within each set of 3, for example, in Kinim, in Shechin, in Choshech, the last makah of each set, there is no forewarning. So what's interesting here is we are dealing with yet another interrelationship and interaction between the will of the king and the onset and timing of the makot. We have that each time, Paro, the first 2 times, Paro is warned. He is given a chance to listen, to capitulate, to free Am Yisrael. 2 strikes and then you're out in the third, right? In the third time, the Makkah comes without forewarning. But since it comes without forewarning, it might then lull Paro into thinking that this is just a natural coincidence, because there was no previous warning. And then once again, he will become recalcitrant, he'll become inflexible, and he'll just think this is not really something coming from a deity, and he will move on. And that's where we start the next set of three once again. Interestingly, in source number 4, Ibn Ezra, and we also have a parallel to that in the Midrash Tanhuma, tells us that in order to understand the symmetry, the arrangement, the structure of the Makot, we should focus, in fact, on the agents, the implementers of the ones who bring about the Makot, because the first three Makot were brought about by Aharon, Dam, Tzvardea, Kinin. The last three Makot of the series, Makat Bechorot will set aside, were brought about by Moshe. The intervening series, Arov, Dever, Shrin, Arov and Dever are brought about by Hashem himself. In fact, with the first three Makot, we have the use of the Mateh, of the rod. In the Makot that were by Moshe, we have the Mateh, but Arov and Devil, the Mateh, the rod, is not used. Shechin, interestingly, it seems to be brought about by all three, Moshe, Aharon, and Hashem. So the pattern is disrupted, that is true, but we have the overall idea. Why is Aharon implementing the first three? We've been taught by the Midrashim, because the land, right, the water and the earth protected Moshe, so Aharon is the agent. Why the last three by Moshe? Because these are the three most severe Makot, and because of that, that means Barad, Arbeh, and Choshech, and it is Dafka in those three Makot, if you paid attention in the this parasha and beginning of, we'll read next week's parasha, we will see that this is when the negotiations become very intense between Moshe and Paro, so it is very fitting that Moshe should bring them about. Why Arov and Dever, only Hashem seems to be the agent of implementation? Because Bedafka, in that second series, it is emphasized that there will be a separation between the Egyptians and the Jews living in Goshen, and this separation, that the Jews will not be affected within Goshen as compared to the Egyptians, that is when Hashem wants to say, I want to emphasize in a more direct manner my providential hand. So we are beginning to see as well that notice in the Ibn Ezra, it emphasizes that the first three Makot, Hayu Bashfalim, were with the lower elements, right? The dust and the water. Whereas the last three Makot were with the Elyonim, right? Barad, Arbeh, Choshech, we're talking about the upper atmosphere and the wind. So it's very interesting that the Midrashim emphasize, and Ibn Ezra says, if you look on the second line, Hamakot Shahayu al Yedei Moshe b'mateh, Hayu be'elyonim, kemo shema'alato elyona mima'alat Aharon. Very interestingly, since Moshe Rabbeinu has a higher status, therefore the Makot that he enacts involve the so-called higher elements, the elyonim, as compared to the lower elements of the water and the dust of the earth. Again, you're beginning to notice that the arrangement of the Makot involved a divine plan, a divine scheme, that Hashem has organized the Makot in such a manner to reveal the fact that these Makot in the confrontation between Hashem and Paro also involve a very interesting sequence and structured order with regard to the human agents and the forces of nature that are involved with them. Let's carry this symmetry even further And by the way, Svulno also has a similar idea in source number 5. Let's carry it further in source number 6. Because what we are beginning to see is that not only the pattern in the onset and the catalyst of the makot and how they're manipulated in nature, the agents of implementation, that not only does this order and pattern enable us to extract and decipher these particular aspects of the makot, but perhaps as well, the setup of series of 3x3 also helps us to decode a broader thematic underpinning, which will help us transition to the next aspect of this, the understanding of the makot. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch has a very interesting analysis. And he says that if you want to understand the setup and arrangement of the makot, you need to go back to the Brit Bein HaBetarim. The Brit Bein HaBetarim emphasized to us that Bnei Yisrael would be suffering a series of 3 stages of persecution, exile and persecution, until they would be redeemed. Yadoa Tedaz, we learn in Breshit Tedvav, Ki Ger Ye Zaracha, Be'eretz Lo Lahem, Ve'avadum, Ve'inu Otam, Arba Me'ot Shana, right? And then Hashem will judge and punish the nation that persecutes us. V'gam et hagoy asher ya'avodu dan anochi, v'achechin yetzu'u b'chush gadol, and then we're going to go out with great possessions. There were 3 stages, and this is a very interesting, I once spoke about this here, this is a very interesting, unusual scenario where Hashem predetermines that we need to undergo the stages of gerut, feeling strange in a foreign land, avdut, enslavement, Inui, affliction, before we would be allowed to stand at Har Sinai and receive the Torah. All other galuyot are not predetermined. They're not predestined. But the way the Brit Bein HaBetarim is formulated as a decree, it indicates to us that Hashem decided we needed to have this threefold experience of Gerut, Avdut and Inui before we would be able to be chosen and designated as the Am Segula, as the chosen nation. Nevertheless, there is always a factor of free will and free choice. Notice the Brit Bein HaBetarim never specified it would be Egypt. It just said in a land not ours. Ger Yezaracha Be'eretz Lo Lahem. So there's always this interesting tension between the wider, divine, the broad divine plan on the one hand and how it is implemented through human free will and free choice. So therefore, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch emphasizes to us that these particular plagues were organized in sets of 3 as midah keneged midah, cause, effect, punishments, in order to pay back the Egyptians for having compelled us to undergo the 3 stages of Gerut, Avdut, and Inui. So for example, he says that when it comes to the first plague in each of the 3 series, so we're talking about Dam, Arov, and Barad, we're talking about how measure for measure in each of these 3, the first of each of the series, the Egyptians were made to feel like strangers in their own land. The Nile River that feeds them is now polluted, right, is now unusable. The wild animals are taking over the land and running rampant. The Barad is causing the Egyptian populace to have to hide in their homes and not feel that they can, right, be part of their land. They feel strangers in their own land. And I've given you the text in source 6 that you can read extensively on your own. Tzvardea, Dever, and Arbea, on the other hand, that is a punishment for the Avdut stage, for the enslavement stage. So the frog, they feel enslaved in the sense that now they are devoid of ownership of any property, which is what a slave feels. So the frogs take over their houses, the pestilence, right, afflicts and destroys all their livestock, the alvin destroys all their crops. Now they feel as if they themselves do not own the land that they are living in. And of course, the affliction, that should be obvious. We are dealing with kinim, shchin, choshech, and all of those. There's more bodily harm, and they feel more oppressed as we were oppressed, being slaves and afflicted and persecuted by them. What's the important idea that may be elicited from the overall concepts that Rav Hirsch is discussing, that the makot are meant to tear down the barrier between master and slave, that there's an overturning of the tables of the sovereignty that they had over us. And this correlates with the message that Hashem is not only going to be manipulating the forces of nature to show that he is the master of the natural world, but he is manipulating the forces of history to show that he is the master over the history of the world, the rulership of the empires. This aspect of the Makot in a pedagogical, didactic sense is elaborated very importantly by the Abarbanel in source number 7. Abarbanel pays attention that within each series of 3 Makot, that there are very important didactic statements that are specified when Moshe approaches Paro. And I've given you those psukim on page 2, right before source 8. At the beginning of the first set of Makot, the first series of 3, the warning emphasizes that Hashem is bringing about these Makot. Why? Bezot teda ki ani Hashem. The second set emphasizes Leman teda ki ani Hashem bekerev haaretz. The third set emphasizes Vavul teda ki ein kamoni bechol haaretz. Abarbanel emphasizes that these are shlosha shorashim. These are 3 important religious principles that Moshe is imparting to Paro. First, Leman te bezot te da ki ani Hashem, that the first set of makot are meant in order to prove that Hashem exists in all of his glory. Leman te da ki ani Hashem bekerev haaretz, the second set of makot, arov dever shchin, is to emphasize, as the Abarbanel says at the top of page 2, shemoshe hiniach she'elohim mashgiach al kol darchei b'nei adam, that there is hashgacha pratit, there is providence in these makot bedafkar. It is emphasized v'hifleti b'yom ahu eretz goshen, that Hashem is going to separate out eretz goshen from all the Egyptians. There is going to be a very important distinction, separation, differentiation. This emphasizes Hashem's hashgacha. Hashoresh hashlishi in the last 3 makot, barad ar bechoshech, bavol teda ki en kamoni bechol haaretz, these most severe makot emphasize, as the Abarbanel says, she Moshe hiniach shehaya ha'eloha yachol leshanot tivei hadvarim u'mechadesham. That bedafka here, Hashem's powers over nature, his omnipotence, is overly and abundantly emphasized. The fact that you can group 3 set didactic groupings emphasizes to us that the makot were not only meant to be punishments, to pay back the Egyptians for everything they have done to persecute us. The makot had a very important educational component. And perhaps we need to also emphasize, it was, as the text in Shmot Perek Yud says, Uleman tesaper beoznei bincha uven bincha, that the education was not only addressed to the Egyptians. It was also addressed to Am Yisrael living in Egypt, who had unfortunately become very assimilated and very enamored with the idolatrous ways of the Egyptians. I think we can summarize this aspect of our analysis. We skip to source number 9. Noted by a modern scholar, Nachum Sarna, who wrote a very fascinating work on Sefer Shmot. And he says the following, and I quote, "The meaning and function of the structural symmetry is always to emphasize that what has occurred is the vindication of God's active presence in the life of the world. In the case of the plagues in particular, precisely because the first 9 are rooted in familiar afflictions, the literary presentation, the organization, the sequence, stresses they are not a fortuitous succession of random, senseless visitations of nature's blind fury, but the calculated, purposeful, directed, and controlled workings of Hashem. Just as God may use a person's fundamentally evil character to further his own objectives, as in the case of Paro's obstinacy, so may he employ the vagaries of nature to achieve his historical goals. This explains why the climactic 10th plague, about which we have not spoken as of yet, must be wholly outside of human experience. It must defy any rational explanation, although we will see that there are those who try to rationalize. It must be clear to all and beyond the possibility of misinterpretation that what took place can only have emanated from a divine source." Nevertheless, it is important to take into consideration that these manipulations of nature, which show Hashem's sovereign powers over nature as well as over history, are elaborated within Midrashic and medieval commentaries as punishments themselves. And even though there are very few texts that mention that they are indeed punishments, in fact, we only read about it in one place in Shmot, in Perek Yud Bet, that Hashem says he is going to enact shifatim, punishments, against the Egyptians. We see that the Midrashic literature in source number 10 elaborates quite extensively on the Midah, Keneged Midah aspect of the Makot, because they want to teach us a very important didactic lesson. So, for example, the bottom of page 2 in source 10. Eser makot kulan midah keneged midah. So one example, dam. Dam is brought because they were preventing the daughters of Israel from being able to do tevilah mitum atam, so that they could then procreate. The Egyptians were preventing Benot Yisrael from doing tevilah so that they would not procreate. Therefore, their waters, the waters of the Nile River, are stricken with dam. Tzvardea. Why tzvardea? I didn't give you all 10, but if you have a chance, you can go back to the original source. But I've given you, I think, a number of them to give you an idea. Mipnei shehayu, top of page 3, mishta'abdim b'Yisrael v'omrim lahem haviu lanu shkatzim u'remasim. They used to enslave the Jews by saying, bring us insects. So therefore, the tzvardea started filling up their own cups. We'll see Abarbanel, if you just look at source number 11 for the moment. Abarbanel has a very similar analysis, but slightly different when it comes to Makot, Dam, and Tzvardea. I think it's interesting for you to see that. The Abarbanel says at the end of the second line, why Makat Dam? Because they had the third decree of Paro, was genocide, to throw the babies into the river. And therefore, Uche'ilu, he says on the end of the third line of source 11, Haya Yo'ol Mitzrayim Malei Dam B'nehem. So therefore, it is as if the, now they see, as if the river is filled with the blood of their children. When it comes to Tzvardea, he says, interestingly, it's because frogs croak. They make a very loud screeching sound, and this is midah keneged midah against tzaakat benot Yisrael v'dimatan alecheyan al harigat b'nehen b'yaor behesbedan al shahaya ha'yaor mechale et pri b'tnehen. Why makat tzvardea? Because this is keneged the cries and the screaming of Benot Yisrael when they are mourning the deaths of their children in the rivers. And I think you can understand that the Midrashim go through all of the specifics of each and every makah in order to analyze why that particular makah as a punishment, midah keneged midah, against the Egyptians. I want you to pay attention that Abarbanel calls this particular angle of analysis in source 11 in the first line, he calls it Seder HaHashkacha HaElokit. Meaning, he's going to present us in two many different ways, but notice that in this particular context, he's emphasizing the order and the arrangement of the makot. And all of this extensive analysis is not delineated within the text of Sefer Shemot at all, right? But the emphasis is that Hashem is premeditating and organizing in a very important sequence and arrangement the makot so that they are midah keneged midah for everything that the Egyptians brought against us. That is, Hashem through the makot is demonstrating his midat hadin, his strong rod of justice, his attribute of midat hadin. On the other hand, if you skip to source number 12, the Midrash says that there is midat hadin against the Egyptians, but the makot were selected, these particular makot, also, unfortunately, to bring vengeance and midat hadin against many members of Am Yisrael. So, particularly, makat choshech is emphasized. Why did Hashem bring makat choshech? Lefi shehayu b'Yisrael poshein, shehaya lahem patronin min ha-mitzrim, v'haya lahem sham kavod ve'osher, v'lo hayu rotzim latzet mi-mitzrayim. Apparently, there were some from Am Yisrael who were favored by the Egyptian and were given a higher status. And it was good for them in Egypt, despite the fact that they were slaves and they did not want to leave Egypt. And so Hashem brought about Makat Choshech so he could destroy those who do not want to leave, and it would not be a humiliation to us because it happens in the thick of darkness. On the other hand, in a positive sense, the Midrash continues and says, where I underlined in the third to last line, Bishloshet yimei ha'afela, natan hakadosh baruch hu et chen ha'am be'enei Mitzrayim v'yashilum, that the thick of darkness enabled Am Yisrael to go into the houses and take back all of the riches that were stolen from them. So we've discussed a number of ways that we can understand the logic, the underlying rationale between the arrangement and the specific selection of these particular makot as compared to other natural calamities. But perhaps we need to also take into consideration on page 4 in source 13 that the Gemara teaches us, Ein lecha kol uma ve'uma shelokeh, she'ein eloheha lokeh ima, she'ne'emar, ובכל אלוהי מצרים אעשה שפטים. As I noted, there is only one place in the entire plague narrative where the makot are referred to as shvatim, as judgment, as punishment. And this is particularly explicated with regard to what? Elohei Mitzrayim, the gods of Egypt, and it is only mentioned one other time, as I gave you in Bamidbar Lamed Gimel, that the makot are referred to as Shefatim. The Midrash therefore tells us, and Rashi is influenced by this Midrash, why was the Nile River struck with the Makkah of Dam? Because of the fact that the Egyptians worshipped the Nile River. Strike Ake Elohat Chila, strike the god first, the Achal Kach Amo. And although we can't delineate this, modern scholarship has attempted to associate this particular aspect of analysis to all 10 Makot, although we can't do it for all 10, we can do it at least for two others, that the sun was regarded by the pharaohs to be a god, the god Re, or also Amon Re, and the worship of the sun god pervaded the ritual of the kings, and so therefore sending a plague of darkness was a way of striking against this particular god, just like the Nile River was deified by the Egyptians as Hapi, H-A-P-I, as the Nile god. In addition, there is a frog goddess. Her name is Hekt, H-E-Q-T, and she was interestingly fancied to be a goddess who assisted women in labor. So therefore, one wonders if the plagues, if that's the case, the plagues of the frogs might be in fact a way of retribution for Paro trying to kill the male babies. What's the whole point of all this? What's interesting is we've mentioned about the Nile River, right? About the sun. We've mentioned about fertility. We've mentioned about natural aspects of within the wider environment of nature or within the natural constitution of the human being, right? Reproduction, fertility. The pantheon of the Egyptian gods was quite extensive. And the pantheon of the Egyptian gods, which comprised over 50 gods, were representative of all of the forces of nature. So therefore, by Hashem attacking these gods at their source, what Hashem is emphasizing through manipulating nature with the Makot is that Hashem is the power over these forces of nature and not the gods in whom the Egyptians believe. And I think based on that, we need to discuss a very important additional aspect to this whole topic about the Makot. And that is, how should we, in fact, understand the naturalistic aspect of these plagues, the relationship between nature and miracle? Because we have a very unusual analysis within the Abarbanel in source number 14. The Abarbanel tells us, remember I said to pay attention, originally he had organized the Makot according to what he called Seder Hashgachi, the providential order. And that's where he noted that we are dealing with the Makot as Midah Keneged Midah, that each Makah is particularly selected, that type of Makah, in order as cause-effect, in order to punish the Egyptians for what they had done to us. But now, the Abarbanel says there's another way to understand the Seder, the arrangement, the order of the Makot. And you notice he calls it in source 14 a Seder Tiv'i. He calls it a natural Seder. Now what's interesting is, when you read this particular analysis, the Abarbanel claims that if you follow the order of the Makot, they seem to be organized as a natural chain of events. You start out with Makat Dam. Why Makat Dam? Because from Makat Dam, he says on the third line, he saviva makat hatzvaldeim. It's a domino effect. All Hashem needed to do was enact makat dam. And from there, seder tiv'i, a natural chain of events, the makot would follow logically in the order that they occurred. Because since you have the stench of the river, ipushmei hayaor, which caused the deaths of the fish, that prompted the frogs to want to leave the river. And then as a result of all of the stench and the decay from the river, which caused a disease within the frogs, and they ended up dying, and all of them piled up, chomarim, that caused the dust to have this stench and this decay, and that became a breeding ground for the kinim. And then as a result of all of this stench with all of the kinim, the land itself became decayed and decomposed, and that brought about, sounds a little like spontaneous generation, but that brought about these animals were wild animals all over. Of course, then that caused the death of the animals, which is devil. And of course, all of this pollution brought about the disease of Shechin. And because of the whole stench, which caused vapors to rise up into the air, it caused this unusual natural situation of the barad. And then the wind started to blow, so that brought the arbeh. And now you've got this very thick fog over the whole atmosphere of Egypt. Well, that's makat choshech. And then amazingly, he says in the last three lines, makat bechorot, hine haya hamechin alea hachoshech. Because you've got this heavy, thick air, avipur atong, it makes everyone sick, kamosha katavu harofeim, like the doctors have written, and that brought about makat bechorot, which you notice he doesn't explain why only the males, and why only the firstborn. But notice that he says, Hine hitba'er gam bazeh ha'ofen habet, shebao ha'makot, last line of source 14, b'seder tivi'i, kefi ha'sibot, v'ha'mesubavim ha'ele, that it came about in a very naturalistic way, natural chain, domino, right, effect, chain of events. Well, we read this, and then we start thinking, is that really what we're supposed to learn about the Makot, that it's just a whole series of natural events? Seems to take away from the providential, divine schema and plan, as I've talked about until now, right? And it seems to take away from the miraculous component. Now, what we could say in defense of the Abarbanel is we could say the following, that he maintains that the greatness of Hashem is that Hashem b'davka works within nature. Not that he has to cancel out and nullify nature, but that Hashem manipulates and works through nature to show that he controls nature. He just started one aspect, makat dam, because Hashem knew it would bring about the whole series of events, because who is the one who implanted the world with the laws and rules of nature, if not Hashem himself? And interestingly, there is precedent for this particular idea. Because in source 15, the Midrash teaches us, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, I'm going to need another 5 minutes. I'll try to work through this as fast as possible. Okay. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Tena'in hi tena kadosh baruch hu im hayam, sheyehe nikra lifnei Yisrael. Hashem made a condition with the sea that at a certain point in the history of the world that the sea is going to split before Bnei Israel. Without getting into it, it's really a play on words. Vayashav ha'am le'etano litna'o shitna'imo. Typical Midrash, just reverses the letters. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah ben Elazar, lo im hayam belvad itna kadosh baruch hu, elai im kol ma shenivra b'sheshet imei b'reshit. Hashem didn't make the condition just with the sea. He made it with everything that he created. That there would be a period of time when, for example, in the time of Yehoshua, Hashem would make the Shemesh, right? Shemesh begivondo. That there would be a time that the Oravim would feed Eliyahu. That there would be a time when the hot, fiery fires would not scorch Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That there would be a time when the lions would not open their mouths and eat Daniel. That there would be a time when the fish would swallow up Yonah and he would not die. So very interestingly, the Mishnah Masechet Avot in Source 16 says that there were 10 things that were created on Erev Shabbat Ben Hashmashot. Among them we see some of the quote-unquote miracles, like the man, like the opening of the earth to swallow up Korach, like the Be'er, like the mouth of the Aton that talks of Bilam's Aton. And the Rambam says, is this the only 10 that we should be thinking about? The Rambam Bedavka says no. The Mishnah is only discussing the 10 things, the 10 quote-unquote miracles that were created. But notice that the Rambam on the last line of page 4 says, She'ar haniflaot v'hamofetim. Listen to his language. Hu simu b'tivei advarim asher na'asu bam ve'et ha'asotam tchila. Meaning, notice the language. The Rambam is saying, miracles, events that we see and we think that they are quote-unquote unnatural, miraculous, really were already husimu b'tivei advarim, were already implanted and pre-programmed in nature that within the larger fabric of the laws and the workings of nature, there would be certain periods of time when certain natural things would act differently, but they were already pre-programmed within quote-unquote nature itself. The Kuzari Rabbi Yehuda Levi says on this Ma'amar of Chazal, in Pirkei Avot, notice what he says on the second line where I quoted you in page 5, that this Me'id, listen carefully, al ha-haskama bein ha-Torah uvein chochmat ha-teva. Shegam shinuyei ha-nohag mikoram ba-teva. Ki chach itna aleihem b'retzon ha-kadmon v'chach heskem aleihem m'sheshet mei b'reshit. This Mishnah Masechet Avot and the Midrash that I also quoted you are showing you that there is a correspondence between Torah and Chochmat HaTeva. That even things that we see, which we think are Shinuyim Mehanohag, are abnormal, right, extraordinary occurrences, quote-unquote unnatural, Mikoram BaTeva. They are really sourced and based and founded in the larger program of nature, because Hashem pre-programmed how everything would work. Misheshet yemei bereshit. On the other hand, one could understand that this particular analysis might not be exactly how what Abarbanel has done with the makot. One could say that therefore each and every makah is understood individually to be pre-programmed into the larger fabric of nature, that Hashem premeditated that there would be times where a miracle, meaning a shinui, a change in nature, would occur, and each and every makah would be understood separately. But Abarbanel has done something different. He has said there's what? A chain of events, that everything one follows from the other. And what's interesting is that in modern scholarship, those modern secular scholars who have attempted to detract and take away from the miraculous component of the natural calamities of the plague narratives, they have gone and swung the pendulum completely to the opposite extreme, and they don't see any divine hand or providence or plan or scheme within the Makot narrative. They see it completely as quote-unquote nature. So starting in 1957, there was a seminal article written by a woman, Greta Hort, and she claimed that there was an unusual inundation that particular year of the Nile River, and the torrent washed down a massive load of red mud, with the main reddening agent being red algae, which discolored and contaminated the waters, and the algae killed the fish, and the dead fish developed anthrax. I have an article from 2002. They're still debating whether anthrax was the bacteria that caused all of these animals to die, and then of course that caused a lot of decay, and it brought about a virulent skin anthrax, etc. You can see how this all continues once again in a chain of events. But when these secular scholars are writing about the plagues from a very scientific point of view, and you can look it up, there are many articles on the plagues in scientific journals, they are obviously only trying to understand the plagues as naturalistic calamities and totally taking away from the whole narrative construct of what we learn when we read the parashiyot about the plagues, i.e. that they're, from their secular perspective, there is no divine providential hand. And because of that, look in sources 17 and 18. The Malbim, who was living in a time of the Haskalah and the Reform movement in the 1800s, the Malbim who was arguing against many of the more secular ideas that the more extreme maskilim were promoting, especially the Reform Jews, regarding the authority of the Torah, both Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. Notice what the Malbim says. The Malbim indicates, V'hinei Hari, Ri is Rabbi Yitzhak Abar Benel, meaning he says, Chipeis latet lamakot seder tivi. And then he quotes you about what Abar Benel says, in this case, in source 17, Makat Dam, source 18 I gave you from Makat Choshech. And then he says in source 17 on the fourth line, V'lo yadati, challenging Abar Benel's premise. Malbim says, I don't understand. Lama yaktin et hanisim. Why is Abar Benel diminishing the force, the weightiness of the miraculous component of the makot? V'itein lahem shalshelet TVs, giving them a natural chain of events. Now, he says, if you read the text very carefully, Abar Benel is also wrong. Why? Because, for example, in Makat Dam, this is the only Makah which tells us there's a defined limit. It only lasted a week. All the other Makot, we don't know exactly how long they lasted. But it says very clearly in Makat Dam, it lasted 1 week. It was completely, that was it. Done, and then it was the river was fine, it was healed, and there were we don't talk about the frogs, and only afterwards, when there's a second warning, right, and Moshe Akas Paro yet again, then we talk about the Tzvardim. He says, and then the Tzvardim are only brought about because Moshe warns and Hashem brings it about. It's not a Sibat TVE, there's no chain of events. Of course, he likes the part of Abar Benel. That's the Siba Hashkachiyit, the part where it was Midah, Keneged Midah, which we talked about, because that shows the providential hand. Same thing in Source 18. The Malbim says on Makat Choshech, Ein da'ati nocha mimeh ma'ashebikei shalshelet sibot tiviyot l'nisei Hashem ele. I don't like, he says, where you're looking for a whole series of natural causes where one just follows from the other. It takes away from understanding the miraculous component. What's interesting, furthermore, is Shmuel David Luzzatto, who also lived around the same time as the Malbim in the 1800s, but he lived in Italy. He was arguing in this particular context against a Protestant Christian historian and theologian of the 18th century, Johann Gottfried Eichhorn, who wrote a seminal academic work called The Introduction to the Old Testament, which was a pioneering work of modern critical biblical scholarship. And Eichhorn was totally taking away from any miraculous component involving the plagues. He was claiming these are just natural calamities that happen every year in Egypt. And in fact, sometimes he laments that there are no travelogues, that the Egyptians have recorded these calamities so he could have more evidence. But he totally was diminishing any miraculous aspect to the Makot. Says the Shaddal, he says, look, I am not going to deny that we're talking about aspects of nature with the Makot, right? Darkness, locusts, frogs, lice, animals, of pestilence. Of course we're talking about aspects and calamities of nature. But we need to pay attention, says the Shaddal, that there is a, as he calls it, as Dr. Brian Alevi, who wrote an article about Shaddal's analysis, it's asonot teva, it's natural calamities, im element al tivi. There's always going to be a supernatural element to each of the makot. So for example, in source 19, Shaddal says, if you look further down after the three dots, hine yadua, ki gam b'maseh haniflaot hakel shomer lishmor darchei hateva b'miktzat. Even when we're talking about niflaot, remember we said the makot were not called makot in the Torah. What were they called? Otot, mofetim. These niflaot, Hashem still does not necessarily completely destroy all of nature. V'chein b'makot Mitzrayim, yitachen lefi dati, shemidech eretz Mitzrayim liot v'kayotzei b'makot ha'ele b'tzadma, k'tzatan b'shana zo, וקצתן בשנה אחרת. אפס, כי בשנה ההיא נתקבצו ובאו כולם, וגם נתחדש בכל אחת מהן איזה עניין שלא היה מדרך הטבע. Even if you want to say that each of these calamities happened in Egypt at some point in time, they may have happened one of them one year, another one another year, but that they should all come within the span of one year, we know the Makot only lasted total one year, that's the al-TV, the supernatural aspect within the TV. Besides the fact that there is always a component within the different makot that emphasizes that there's something unusual about them. So for example, he says in source 20, whereas Eichhorn claims that makat choshech is a chamsin, a dust storm, which causes darkness, says Shaddal in the third line, Omnam ein miderech haruach ahu, sheyimashech mimenu choshech gamur. Even if you want to say it's a chamsin, from this heavy wind, this dust storm, that would certainly not bring about choshech gamur, where you can't walk out of the house. And usually it's brought about by a wind, and there's no wind mentioned with regard to makat choshech. You can see once again how our commentators are struggling and confronting the challenges which are brought about by many scholars of their day to try to diminish and mitigate the miraculous, because we are dealing with, of course, calamities that affect natural forces. Amazingly, in source 21, Shaddal says there are those who say that B'nai Yisrael went and killed the firstborn, that they went into the houses and killed the firstborns, that somehow Shaddal says, how could we slaves have gone in and had the chutzpah to kill firstborns? But notice that Shaddal in source, on page 6 at the end of the source, says, such hypotheses, which to Shaddal, especially with Makat Bechorot, that Moshe and he took his people and went into the houses and just killed male firstborns, he says, Re'ei kama bitulim ha-kofarim ma'amisim al atzmam. Look at the narashkeit that these heretics are analyzing. Kedei shelo lekabel aleihem ki Hashem oseh niflaot. They're going so far out of their way to say, as apikorsut, heresy, that Hashem is not performing great miracles with the Makot. Look how far they're going to present such ridiculous hypotheses. And I think it's important that modern scholars like Nachum Sarna and a scholar Moshe Greenberg therefore say the following. Let me read Sarna. In truth, in source 22, the biblical narrative says nothing about causal connections or about an abnormal inundation of the river. It does, and please scratch out the word not, that is a typo, my mistake. It does insist that the series of plagues was the product of divine deliberation. It is the implicit presupposition of all that is described, that the guiding hand of providence is detectable. Now listen what he says now. Lessen the nature of the calamities, then in their terrifying intensity, their timing, their concentrated force, and above all, the shielding of the Israelites from their effects. The entire account has a didactic and theological purpose, not a historiographic one, and the same idea is emphasized by Moshe Greenberg. I want to just conclude. I don't have time to read the Malbim inside of 24 and 25. They are the most unbelievably beautiful commentaries of the Malbim on two texts from Tehillim Tzadik Gimel and Shmuel Aleph Perek Bet and Shirat Chana. But I will only quote to you what I bold-faced. Perhaps we really need to look at things from a very different perspective, despite the fact that we all saw that the Malbim himself was not enamored with the Seder TV approach of the Abarbanel. But ultimately, the Malbim says, in these other contexts, not in his commentary on the Makot in Sefer Shmot, okay, but in these contexts, ultimately the Malbim says, maybe we need to look at things very differently. That really, nature and miracle are two sides of the same coin. Because he says, where I bold-faced in source 24 at the bottom of page 6, Hanhagat ha-teva ha-kvua la-yeter se'et min ha-nes. Gam ha-nes in the last line, gam ha-teva, hu-nes kavua, ve-ha-nes hu-teva ara'iyit. Teva, he says, nature is a permanent miracle. What does that mean? It means that he's applying an approach of deists of his day. Deism said God created the world, but the world is like a machine. It runs on autopilot, and the Malbim talks about the machine analogy. So therefore, it's fixed laws of nature. Yes, God created the laws of nature, but they're fixed. They're immutable. They're unchanging. Because if you change a little knob on the machine, the whole machine will fall apart. The Malbim says, nah. Hashem created Teva, but it's as if, kivyachol, he's got his finger on the button of the machine all the time. If he lifts up his finger, the machine will fall apart. It won't work. It's not on autopilot. So Teva is a nes in and of itself. Nes means that Hashem has an active involvement in it every day. We say this in the bracha before Kriyat Shema. Ha-mechadesh b'tuvo b'chol yom tamid ma'aseh bereshit. But nes, he says, is also Teva. What does that mean? It means that when a miracle is happening, it acquires a certain quote-unquote nature, that this is the way the ocean is going to act now at this particular time. It's going to follow its own set of rules. But what's the difference? Nace, what we call miracle, is only temporary, whereas Teva is what? It is tamid. And if you look at page 7, he says, therefore, ein hevdel beinal bein hanes. Rak bateva ha'emid koach ze le'olam, ubanes ha'emido rak lefi sha'a. As he says in source 25, ha'teva hi bri'ah matmedet. Ha'teva hu'nes matmid v'hashkacha matmedet. If we understand teva, nature, as a miracle in and of itself, because it involves the constant involvement of Hashem to make sure that this world does continue to operate according to the laws of nature, then we will appreciate that when Hashem was combating the so-called gods of nature, the Egyptian gods of nature, he was emphasizing that he is the sovereign power over all of the world, both in its natural environment as well as the historical forces that control the destiny of the world. Thank you. I'm sorry.